Welcome to Job Tales, the show where we find out about different professions from the people who know. Each week, I'll speak to a new guest with a fascinating job. We talk to event organizers, hairdressers, acoustic designers, mathematicians, you name it. We hear about their personal paths to doing what they do, the skills required, and the tools they use for the job. I'm Laura Leoncini, and today my guest is Davide Nicolini, Program Manager at the European Space Agency. Now, this is for me a special opportunity because we're about to explore the world of rockets. You know, we always hear about the work of astronauts, and this is fantastic. But you know, there is a whole universe that is less visible to us. And today we delve into this ecosystem, learning what jobs revolve around the launch of Ariane 6, the process of entry into service, and how the industry is rapidly evolving to encompass commercial and civil applications. So Davide Nicolini, thank you for being here, my guest at the Job Tales edition of this year. And I am so happy to have you because there's not much information from laymen such as myself and maybe some of the listeners to what is it that you do as a program manager at the European Space Agency and specifically for the Ariane 6. Please tell me what you do.
Thank you, Laura. So I work at the Space Transportation Directorate. So I work on our two launch systems. Particular now recently, I've been working on Ariane 6 transition, we call it. So the entry into service of Ariane 6 after the first qualification flight. I've previously worked on Vega, which is our smaller European rocket. These are the two, Ariane and Vega, are our two workhorses in European access to space currently. Because now there's new players coming and entering into the service in Europe. But currently, these are the two European ESA rockets flying.
That's amazing. And so it's a very important job that you have. And when we were talking just before the interview started, you were talking about one flight first, and then you take care of the others. So how is it organized? Who takes care of what? And what do you do when managing these space launch systems?
So we are, like NASA, we are at ESA, we are a space agency which is ultimately responsible vis-a-vis our, we are a public agency, obviously. We work for the government in All Europe, right. Work for the 27 ESA member states. These are mainly EU states, but not only. And there's other states who are part of ESA, which are not EU. And what we do is we are mandated to develop a European access to space and European satellites on one hand. In my specific case, in our case, we work on the launch systems. And we rely on industry. So we have large companies that build or part or integrate the system. And so we don't build anything in-house. We contract and we manage the execution of these contracts. We have a mixed team of managers, of engineers, of administration as well. But we do a technical and financial and programmatic oversight of the development of these rockets and of the commercialization of these rockets, meaning in this case, specific to my case, when we discussed about what is the difference between the first flight and the first batch of operational flights, development of a complex system like a space rocket, it is not just a one shot and go. Many other engineering domains is actually the same. I mean, you're not complete after the first that went well. You have several flights to smooth in the process, to learn how to make it. We call it learning curve. So we have other factors which may come in. We have maybe even technical problems to solve which are out of norm in the beginning. And so on the public side, even if we hand over to our commercial operator, because we don't, the European Space Agency, we don't operate commercially the launches, but Ariane and Vega do go on the commercial market. So we hand over after having developed these rockets to commercial operators. But the first batch of operations, we do it jointly because we want to have a smooth entry into service. We want to facilitate the entry into service. And so that's why we have these programs that we call them now on Ariane 6 transition, but we had them previously also on the Vega and even previously on our previous rockets. I mean, the ESA has been developing launch systems since the late 70s. The Ariane evolved into several different versions, bigger and more powerful. Then the Vega came into service. But let's say the principles are the same. Let's say we public sector, we focus with industry, we contract industry, develop the first, then we help entry into service. And then at some point when it's stable, we step out and we limit ourselves to support financially if necessary. Mm-hmm. We do have some oversight on the evolution if we have to evolve. So we still manage the evolution of the rocket if we have to increase performance. But to say 90% of the work is done autonomously by industry once things are stable.
So, I mean, listening to you, I'm imagining that there's a lot of engineering work at hand. And so are you an engineer covering this position?
Yes, I am. I'm an engineer, definitely. I have followed the classical path of master's in engineering, aerospace in my specific case. Most of us who work on the rocket, I would say, are engineers, but not necessarily are aerospace. I mean, there's a lot of different engineers. There's different disciplines in the rocket. In my case, I'm an aerospace engineer. Clearly, I come from the, I have worked on propulsion. I worked after the master's on a PhD, and I focused a lot on propulsion. So it's the engine of the rocket. I initially worked on spacecraft propulsion, actually, plasma engines and ion engines, which seems like a fancy word, seems a lot like Star Wars technology, but actually we have now many operational. We have many satellites, even ESA satellites flying to different planets, running on ion engines and plasma thrusters. So now I would say it's not science fiction, it's real fiction. But I say I come from the propulsion domain. I have then also worked into knowing a bit about finance and economics, and I did an MBA specific to technology. I focused on operations, so I have studied a lot in different domains. But I would say that the key experience important for working in this domain is engineering, obviously, but not only. I mean,
not only. Okay. And also, if you're like a mechanical engineer, electrical engineer, there are chances that you might work at the European Space Agency, right?
Absolutely. We have all the people who are taking care of avionics. They are
electrical
engineers.
There's a bunch of.
Every domain, you need the best specialist, right? If you look at materials, you need a materials specialist. If you look at chemistry, you want a chemistry specialist. So in fact, it's not only limited to engineering, but mainly engineering, but not only. If physicists and chemists and whatever is really needed for the different disciplines to put together. Right. Now, we're working, speaking of rockets, remember, we do a lot of spacecraft in ESA. So in both cases, you want to have a background which is compatible to the different specializations, but it's quite a broad background which is accepted if you do have know-how, right?
Okay, yeah, that's good to know. Yeah, because I imagine it's a very sought-after job. So my $10 million question would be: how do you land a job at ESA?
Oh well, ESA is a government agency, so you have to. All the positions are public and published on our website, and I think even advertised in different channels. But it's similar to what NASA does. It's also a government agency as well. So you have it published on the website. You apply to a position, and if you're selected, you have the job.
You have to be European in order to apply?
To be an employee, you have to be European. Now, if you're an external contractor, then it doesn't matter what nationality you have. But if you, there is a nationality. European means anyone who has a passport of the member states of ESA.
Okay.
So it can be it can be any state that is participating in ESA. Yeah.
Good to know. And so, in your particular case, did you go straight into working for the space agency, or did you do other things before?
I worked in also other sectors before, not really related to space. I worked a bit on the nanotechnology domain and the biotech domain. I have worked, I started working in ESA. I was pretty young. I was 29, something. So I did have, I've been working on the space sector at the European Space Agency since now over 20 years, and I have worked on spacecraft, I work on propulsion, I worked on rockets, launch systems in the last 13 years. But let's say I have worked on many different aspects of what DISA does. I find it fascinating that we do so many nice things. So I always try to catch as much as I can by once in a while changing domain. Not that often, but as much as I could.
Yeah. You know, thinking about, you know, we watch a lot of movies and the media are, you know, the first thing that you think of an astronaut, and then you think of those moments, you know, very dramatic moments where the space rockets get launched and everybody's applauding. Now, is that a myth or does it actually happen?
Well, it's not a myth because you see it. It did happen and it still does.
In movies, so yes.
These are real videos. They're not staged.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, it's clear that in the early days, it was, and I mean the early days, the Apollo program, what created the space program in the U.S., but in the world, it was incredible for those days. And then, you know, to see people flying into space and going into finally landing on the moon, or it was an incredible, let's say, there was incredible innovation in the sector done. Also because, you know, I mean, this is public knowledge, but it was a kind of Cold War between the American and the U.S. there, who gets far into space. So there was an enormous amount of resources put. And so the acceleration done in those years was tremendous. And mm-hmm. if you would look at the acceleration in the domain we have after that, so since the mid-70s, there were some really incredible step forwards as well, but let's say not at that pace. So if you would say now, I mean, if you're looking at a launch, is that an exceptional event today? I would, if you call an exceptional event something that happens once per day, then I don't know. It's not really an exceptional event, right? There's in average, there's a launch per day now in the world. There's at least 5 to 7 launches per week. If you put together the Chinese, the American, the Russians, the Japanese, and the Indians, and I mean, especially now the commercial launches and SpaceX. If you take SpaceX alone, they're launching 60 a year. So that makes you know, twice per month. And that's one company alone. So if you add the whole world together, I mean, there's an amazing amount of launches happening. So it's still exceptional. It's a complex thing. It's a very complex thing to build a rocket. It's a very beautiful thing to see a launch. All this energy and this and it's still a lot of work for who's working on the rocket. But space is now becoming a commercial endeavor. It's beyond the military, beyond the civil, the science. It's also a commercial business. And you know, things that today you have on your phone like GPS and maps, if you don't have rockets, they're not going to happen, right? So you really need it now. It's becoming a need. It's becoming something that you really need to have on a constant basis. So I digressed a bit, but let's say it's still a very incredible thing to see, but it's also a commercial business. It's like watching a plane take off. It's an amazing thing to watch a plane take off. Mm. Like a million flights per month. So is it? It's also a turning business, a turning industry, and space is a growing industry.
And exactly, because with the commercial coming in, it means also there will be new jobs and new profiles, I guess, also in the space industry. I did interview also someone who was heavily into this business on the commercial end, the Space Cargo International, and then he was telling me, you know, depicting like what's the world going to be like, you know, the training, the future, you know, tourists, space tourists, or trying to, you know, figure out how to make a restaurant up in space. And it is going to change. We have no idea today because it's such an early stage, but there's a lot of, you know, investment and you know, commercial effort. So how do you see the change happening? You know, you've been now for a few decades in this industry. Do you see already some change compared to 15 years ago?
Few decades, you make me feel old. You're right, I am. It's a few decades, so it might
be a few decades.
It might be 2 decades. There was a real change. There was a real change that happened really in the decades. I mean, there was an initiating event that happened under the Obama administration in the U.S. So this is the United States, not in Europe, but let's say clearly the leading space country has initiated what was called commercial space transportation. And that was probably 20 years ago when I started. And it was mainly a regulation, and it was mainly a different approach and a parallel approach to purely government space access, which was NASA at the time and ESA and all the government agencies. And in these two decades, I have seen gradually the shift from a government space to a commercial space. And an actor, everybody knows, SpaceX and the Musk company that grew from being a very small startup of being now the world leader in space access and very soon also in space telecommunications. So that happened not by coincidence. It happened because governments wanted to do so. The U.S. Mm-hmm. government did it 2 decades ago almost. The European governments are doing it now. Now we have a huge impetus in Europe to also implement all the regulatory change to enable commercial space. And there's a lot of startups, in fact, growing in Europe. In the last 5 years, there's several. And so I've seen a transformation in my career, absolutely, from a pure government and military. So we don't work, ESA is a civil agency, so we don't work on military, even though we do have some dual programs like Galileo, but let's say we are a civil agency. So we have seen, let's say, civil space, which was research, exploration, everything related to telecommunications was supported by ESA, but was not our main mandate. So anything like TV, satellite TV existed already since the 80s, but I see that was a very small niche. And now, 20 years later, like you say, we have people who are planning to open a hotel in space. I don't know when, but but we had a lot of people who went to space paying, people who paid to go in space. We had, things have changed dramatically. And so, in fact, we are adapting to it. Governments, I mean, if I take the case in certain European governments, I mean, leading European governments in the space transportation domain, for example, like France and Italy, they have now space is not in the research ministry affair. It's a industry ministry affair, you see. And so, so why? Because there has been a change. And so governments have adapted to this change. And so will it continue to increase? Yes. I mean, forecast is space is, it's increased from a couple of billion euro per year business. And now it's in the tenths of hundreds of billions and it will keep growing. I guess at some point it will I see it personally as you can take a parallelism of commercial aviation. I mean, in the 1940s, you needed, you had still government, building planes and operating planes. And then you have an operators, and then as the industry becomes more mature, and today you would never fly on a public operated plane, right? You would fly, there are still public companies who operate, obviously, but primarily it's a commercial affair. And so I would say that the trend is eventually that space will be a lot a commercial affair, except for what has no commercial value, clearly. Science, pure science, exploration where there's no money to be made, that will be a government affair, obviously. So space, civil, governmental space will continue for sure, forever. But there will be a gigantic sector
increasing, in commercial. And to that extent, about the future of the professionals that are going to be involved with ESA, NASA in the United States. What advice do you have, for someone who wants to enter this line of work?
Well, first of all, there's a broad, wide range of expertise needed. I don't think that if you're not an aerospace or space engineer, you cannot enter the domain at all. I mean, I think people are working from different domains. So I think there's need for specific engineers. There's need for physicists. There's need for economists. There's need for, especially if it's a commercial business, right? So there's marketing. If you're sales, you have to sell. So, but let's say if you're really now focusing on the technology of the rocket itself, clearly that is comparable technology of what you have maybe in the aeronautics domain, a bit more. There's some specific technologies that are more extreme in the space, in a rocket or a spaceship has some let's say domains which are really specific, which are not in the aeronautics domain, but a lot of the base core is comparable. So again, aeronautics, mechanical, electrical engineers. That's the background really where you want, if you like to be working or contributing or building a rocket or a spaceship, clearly you need some engineering background, but you have a wide choice.
Yeah. And then, you know, looking back your career, and is there something that you wish someone had told you before that you didn't know?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, that would be great. I'll tell you everything you need to know before.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't say no. I mean, there's no irreversible there in your job career path. You can, I think there's amount, there's so much work now because it's a growing sector in the space domain that I think that if you discover what you picked is not your favorite, I'm sure you have time to readapt and change. So clearly my advice is that there's no need to be focused and stuck on one thing. And I'm saying this now, I need to say some of the institutional, some of our ESA programs are extremely long. I have to say this. I mean, it took 20 years to, from conception, approval of a space station program to get the European Space Station module operational. I think the Columbus module is really a 20-year program, something like that. So clearly,
you have to be patient.
If you love it, if you love that thing so much, you can do it for 20 years. Yes, you can.
But
I also believe that there's so many, and maybe in the old days, you didn't have many programs to pick, so you were kind of stuck in one. But nowadays, there's so much happening that I think you can, you know, you start in one, and if you're not sure that's the best one, you can change, and you have so many opportunities.
Awesome. And let's say one last quick question that we can squeeze in. Do you have an anecdote that you can share with us about your, you know, any part of your job or something that happened in the past that is worth mentioning?
That's also an interesting question. Now, I would say the most fascinating part of the job, let's put it that way, rather than anecdote, I'd say what I really can say, here, wow, now I understand why I was doing this. In my case, working on these rockets, when you design them, you see them on the screen, on a computer screen, and you see parts of it, but it's never really the wow effect when you see it there in front of you. This gigantic thing, and you think, wow, that thing can fly, actually.
Well, hard to miss.
Sign it to fly. It's like a 60-story, you know, 60-meter size thing. And then seeing these things fly, the launch is a very short event, but it's such a powerful event. And, you know, the engines that power these rockets, they can light up, the whole Switzerland can be lit up. And the amount of power the amount of power that is emitted in those seconds of launch is in the order of terawatts. So it could light up half of Europe, only for a few minutes. But let's say that's the power level. And so when you see it in front of you, that's really wow. You said, wow, okay, now I understand why I spent all these years banging my head on that. I said, that's really a...
So it sparks your passion again.
I mean, clearly, if you're an astronaut, you're really in it, and then that's your job, being in it every day. That's really the top of the chain of the space, flight, living the experience on a daily basis. But if you're an engineer working on it, let's say there's a lot of hard work, a lot of work which is not really on the terrain, but again, it pays off if you're really, that's what you want to do, and you want to see these things fly and operate.
David, thank you so much. It's been so interesting. And I wish you all the best for the remainder of your career, decades still to come.
Thank you.
That was Davide Nicolini, Program Manager at the European Space Agency. If you'd like to listen to this episode again or more from the JobTales series, go to worldradio.ch/JobTales or search JobTales, TALES, wherever you get your podcast. I'm Laura Leoncini, and I'll be back next week for another episode of Job Tales with a brand new guest the same time next week on WRS.